Thanks for downloading a 3CR podcast. 3CR is an independent community radio station based in Melbourne, Australia. We need your financial support to keep going. Go to www.3cr.org.au for more information and to donate online. Now stay tuned for your 3CR podcast.
There is a place where time stands still, where nature is harsh and demanding, where only the quick and the strong and the deadly can survive. This place is no place for civilized man.
I want my land.
Took it in the guts, Barry. Far away from my
All you've got to do now is pass the Australian culture test. Three simple questions, three correct
How the hell
answers,
did you get all this
and
together?
You go through that doorway to the greatest little country in the world.
Good morning, everybody. This is Annie for Showreel on 3CR, your community radio station. And of course, this is the station, the time when we talk about Australian films. And today we're going to talk to Alex Livingston, who is part of Defend the Wild. G'day, Alex. How are you?
Yeah, really good. Thanks for having me on.
Yeah, now the reason for why we've got you on is because you've got an event coming up at St Kilda Town Hall Friday, August the 14th, tomorrow. But the event is built around a couple of films that have been made, and this is what we're focusing on here is films as forms of activism and education. It's really important, these films, aren't they, because of the conversation that you're creating.
Yeah, absolutely. So both of the films are about dingoes, an iconic Australian animal who unfortunately is quite misunderstood. Many people don't know that across vast areas of our continent, dingoes are managed through lethal control. So it's legal across much of mainland Australia to trap, poison and shoot dingoes, and even on public conservation areas like national parks. So basically the two short films, they both run for around about 10 minutes each. The first one we produced in collaboration with our partners Dingo Culture, and the film is all about the cultural relationship that many First Nations people share with dingoes and the aspirations that many have to see them protected on country. And the second film is a Landholders for Dingoes film, which basically highlights how some graziers are increasingly finding that keeping dingoes on country is actually beneficial to their production. And this is mainly because dingoes' role in the environment is to basically keep macropods, so kangaroos and wallabies, in balance, which prevents overgrazing. But they also have a really important role in modern day, where we have a lot of introduced species. Dingoes are known to completely eradicate introduced goats from landscapes, and they also suppress introduced species like pigs, foxes, cats, things like that. So they are a very important animal to have in the environment to ensure that our landscapes remain resilient and healthy. And they're also a very good ally in the biodiversity crisis, because obviously suppressing those introduced species has a flow-on impact on many of our at-risk native wildlife.
In fact, let's go to Moot, Calling the Dingo Back to Country. I mean, I found both of the films absolutely illuminating, but the first one, yeah, I did. And I really encourage people to go and have a look at these films and to join into the panel discussion that's going to be held afterwards. The first one that's about Moot, Calling Dingo Back to Country, is fascinating because, of course, it's from the point of view of Indigenous Australians, the First Peoples, and their perspective on their role in championing the stopping of the eradication of the dingo is personalised, and they call the dingo their countrymen. I mean, this is absolutely to the core of the issue, isn't it?
Yeah, so, I mean, I have the absolute privilege of working really closely with, I guess, you know, you could call her my partner in crime, Sonia Grant. She's a Jitterbol Rainforest Aboriginal woman from Tully in far north Queensland. She's the founder of Dingo Culture, and she also is the National First Nations Dingo Coordinator, which is a newly formed role at Girigan Aboriginal Corporation. And basically that role's been set up in response to the National First Nations Dingo gathering that happened in 2023. And one of the outcomes of that gathering was that someone is placed in a role to assist custodians across the continent with their aspirations for dingoes on country. So in my work with Sonia, I've had the privilege of connecting with many cultural custodians across the continent and hearing their stories, their connection, and also their pain that they feel when they have their countrymen removed from country, and the impact this has not only on the ecology, but it also has a deep cultural harm that comes with it. So it's been, you know, such an honour and a privilege to better understand that relationship that exists between many cultural custodians and dingoes, and also understand where a lot of people's aspirations are for the future of dingo management. And I think something that we continue to advocate for, and certainly something that we keep hearing feedback on, is that cultural custodians, given they've lived alongside dingoes for thousands of years, they form an important part of their culture. They understand they form an important part of the ecology of the continent. And many custodians want to see First Nations people at the forefront of dingo management. They know their country. They have amazing skills. There are many Indigenous ranger groups across the continent that are already taking the lead on dingo management. You've got the Minyamai Indigenous Rangers, their country's Evans Head, which is Banjalang country in northern New South Wales. Girigan Aboriginal Corporation represents 9 traditional owner groups across far north Queensland in the wet tropics. They are doing amazing dingo monitoring on their country. You've got Dalruck Aboriginal Corporation over in Western Australia in Esperance. So we're seeing a lot of these Indigenous ranger groups really at the forefront of better understanding dingoes on country, their movements, their family groups. And that's really important because it is, but also something that people don't realise is whilst we're doing these sort of mass killing programs that are funded by our government and often delivered by our government, that we actually don't have a solid database of information about dingoes' population dynamics on country. So we're seeing indiscriminate poisoning and killing of dingoes out on country, and there's actually not a real understanding of how their populations are holding up. So we could really be on the precipice of collapse for some local populations.
It's interesting because, just as an aside, I recently did an interview with someone about a local history. It was Fitzroy North, and it's from its earliest points. And apparently in the earliest times of European settlement, the governor gave orders for all dogs to be shot. Now, most of the dogs were actually with the Indigenous people. And it sort of harkens to this connection that Europeans have with a hatred of wolves or a fear of wolves. And also, of course, the eradication of the Tasmanian tiger. There is a psychological upheaval in the European mind. And this really is at the nub of this destruction, this horrible destruction of dingoes, really, isn't it?
Yeah, look, and I think we understand that for people who are farming livestock, of course, seeing your animals, if they've been predated on by an animal in the environment, we understand that that can be hard to witness, and it's also hard on people economically when they're trying to run a business. But something that we work really hard on is, I think, you know, in issues like this, often I think people default to this sort of us versus them narrative. And that's something we wholeheartedly reject. Like our aim is to ensure that all stakeholders in this issue, which is conservationists, scientists, landholders, First Nations people, there are many, many stakeholders part of this. I guess, debate. And unfortunately, current management is only really catering to one stakeholder, but we do believe that there is management that can ensure that all stakeholders' interests are protected. So our practical action items is we want to see governments redirect funding that is currently being poured into ineffective, culturally harmful and ecologically damaging methods of controlling dingoes to instead fund extension services for landholders to enact things like guardian animals, other aversion techniques that can be used at strategic times of the year, you know, strategically placed fencing, non-lethal means of protecting livestock. And it's really sort of shifting that mindset away from predator removal towards livestock protection. And that's what we really want to see. We want to see a coming together of stakeholders so that we can ensure that everyone's interests are protected, we can have livestock protected in the environment, and we can also see our beautiful dingoes continue playing their ecological and cultural role in the environment.
And of course, that's where this film, Wooleen Utilising Dingoes as a Management Tool, comes in. I mean, it's absolutely eye-opening, actually.
Yes. Yeah, it's... I often describe Wooleen as Australia's Wolves of Yellowstone story, because many people know the story of wolves being reintroduced to Yellowstone National Park in the US after being absent for a really long time. And the amazing and eye-opening result of that was that the wolves had such a huge impact on the broader environment, so much so that they actually changed the behaviour of the rivers.
And yeah, I think that the rivers. Wooleen, amazing.
Yes, and exactly. And I think that Wooleen is an incredible piece of evidence to show that dingoes have that same impact on our natural environment, removing the massive goat population that was at Wooleen Station at the time, and also bringing the kangaroo population back into equilibrium, and it totally transformed the landscape.
Amazing. Yeah, I mean, people have to go and watch the films. It's going to be at the St Kilda Town Hall on Friday, August the 14th. That's tomorrow. What time is it starting?
Yes, the films start at 6:30, but our doors are open from 5 p.m. We've teamed up with our amazing friends at Yulee's Brewery, so they'll be there serving drinks and some nibbles. And, yeah, we'd love for people to come along, have a chat and join the discussion about this amazing animal.
Well, because David Pollock from Wooleen Station from Western Australia is going to be there, as well as Sonia. She's going to be there, Sonia Grant, who's from...
Sonia Grant.
Yep. And that's what about right. the cinematographer and ecosystem biologist? Yeah,
we have Dr. Daniel Hunter, who has just a plethora of experience with dingoes in the wild. He's done amazing cinematography with BBC, National Geographic, the likes of David Attenborough. So he has just spent pretty much an unrivaled amount of time just observing dingoes in their natural habitat. So he has an amazing... range of understanding of dingoes. And also we have Yaron Cousins Bundle, who's a Gutjimara traditional owner, so we're really excited to have her as well.
Oh, that's fantastic. Okay, thanks very much for taking some time to talk to us today, Alex.
Yeah, thank you so much for having me. Appreciate it.
What happens when dingoes return to country? Find out at a special evening presented by Dingo Culture, Defend the Wild and the Dingo Conservancy. Experience two powerful short films, Mort, Calling Dingo Back to Country, and Wooleen, Utilising Dingoes as a Management Tool, followed by an expert panel discussion and audience Q&A. Friday, August the 14th, St Kilda Town Hall at 6:30 p.m. Book now at defendthewild.org or go to events.humanitix.com and search for Dingo. The Dingo Conservancy is a 3CR supporter.
Dum da 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 dum da 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 boom 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 boom. Hi, I'm Rod Quantock, and you're listening to Fill in the Dots. You know who you're listening to. Why do I have to tell you who you're listening to? You know who you're listening to. You're listening to, yes, Fill in the 3CR Community Radio. You got it right. You've won a giraffe. We're at 8:55 a.m. We're on digital radio and streaming at 3cr.org.au. 3CR has been making trouble since 1976, and occasionally I've been part of the trouble that's been made. It's a vital part of our media landscape, and I'd encourage you to get a hacksaw, an oxyacetylene torch, and go up to the Dandenongs and bring down all those broadcast towers that aren't 3CR's towers, and let's make 3CR the only source of information to an information-starved, dumbed-down Australian community. Written, authorised and spoken by Neil Mitchell.
And you're with Annie on Showreel on 3CR, your community radio station. And that, of course, was the wonderful Rod Quantock. And, of course, the film Rod Quantock, Comedy Warrior, is now showing at the Nova. So get your ticket and have a look. And just fantastic. Relive or experience for the first time. A truly, truly great Australian comedian, and within his own milieu. Fantastic. We're going to go on now to I gathered this material, which is a little bit dodgy, the sound, but it's worthwhile listening to. It's only short. It's Dan Jackson. He was speaking at the end of his premiere showing of Death of a Shaman as part of MIFF. And of course, MIFF goes till August the 23rd. It's incredibly popular. It's very difficult to get things, but I realise now that they've bowed to public demand, because they're also doing some rescreening of things that have become incredibly popular. So if you are finding it difficult to find tickets, keep a lookout for the rescreenings that they're going to be doing of the most popular films that have been shown at MIFF. This is a film called Death of a Shaman. It was about exploring the role of a shaman, Rafael Santi, Ecuadorian Amazonian shaman, as he coaches his grandson Jordi into becoming the next shaman in their community. But as you find out, it's at the same time as Ecuador exploded with Amazonian Indians going to the capital to try and unseat the president, who was trying to allow further taking of Amazonian lands for oil exploration by foreign nationals. It was fascinating, because it also pointed out in the film that the president that had been elected as the saviour of the people was actually assassinated in a air crash, and then they put in a puppet. So, you know, it's all pretty tricky stuff. This is the conversation that Dan Jackson had after the screening of Death of a Shaman.
Well, my interest in the subject matter began in university, actually. I majored in Latin American studies, and with a specific focus on kind of indigenous cosmovision and spirituality. And I had a very specific interest in indigenous spirituality in Ecuador, in the Amazon. It has been 14 years in the making, not that I've been working full-time on it for 14 years. The first time I went there, myself and a good friend of mine, we bought a car in Buenos Aires with the plan to circumnavigate South America. It would be a good idea to be productive and shoot some projects. The first port of call was stopping in a favela, a slum in Rio de Janeiro, which became the first feature documentary. And then we continued driving around, ended up in Ecuador. I had this plan to find indigenous Ecuadorian shaman, which was much harder than you might think. I mean, they're everywhere, but there are so many who position themselves and a place for tourists. So they'll make ayahuasca, they'll give it to you, you'll trip it out. But they're not broadly understood as shamans in their communities or in the. I drove around Ecuador for probably 6 weeks on this shaman hunting adventure. I couldn't find one. And in my despair, I ended up in a bar in the Stutter province and just happened to be sitting next to a butterfly biologist. He was like, oh, you're looking for a shaman. Like, I've got the guy for you. So the next day, he took me deep into the jungle. I met Raphael and his family. And they took me even deeper into the jungle to, you know, visit many of their spiritual locations. The moment I knew that this was my guide was Eduardo, one of the main characters of the film, went out to catch dinner for us to eat. He was an armadillo on the end of a machete. He was like, dinner guys, they cooked the armadillo. I instantly got violently sick. Probably jungle parasites, I don't know. And I told Raphael, I told the shaman, mate, I'm not doing very well here. And he ran off into the jungle, assembled a concoction of, you know, dozens of different leaves, gave it to me, and cured me then and there. So we've become great friends and almost family over a 14-year period. Like, I've watched many of their kids, Geordie being one of them. He was 5 or 6 years old when I was first there, and I've seen him grow up iteratively over the years. Initially going in, there's suspicion, and understandably, because, you know, people coming from the outside, especially, you know, white guys wanting things from them, they're naturally incredibly suspicious of that, because there's been a long history of, excuse my French, getting fucked over by people who look like me coming in and, you know, offering the world, what have you. I think the trust and the relationship was built over a very long period of time. I also made a strong point to invite them in into the creative process from the beginning. One of the central storylines in the film is this passing down of ancestral wisdom from Raphael to Geordie, and that came from the community, because I think they saw me and my camera in a way as like a time capsule. They were very aware that, you know, perhaps their ancestral wisdom was not long for this world, but it could well disappear over the coming generations. So I think that they saw what I was doing as something that would safeguard that for future generations, and it would be a film that they could show their grandchildren and great-grandchildren and so on and so forth. And then the hardcore political uprising just happens while I was there. Happily living in the jungle, getting food poisoning and living an idyllic life, and then all of a sudden the entire country erupted into protest, and I was swept up in a convoy of tens of thousands of indigenous warriors, literally spear-wielding, as you would have seen, travelling to the capital city, Quito, to overthrow the president, which I was into. Very happy to accompany them and tell that story. So part of you know, the creative drive from it came from the community in the terms of the succession storyline, and the other part was just purely right place at the right time, or, you know.
So there was a question too about Geordie. Do you know what we're at now? Have you got any updates?
Yeah, I do. I spoke to him yesterday.
Great.
He's still very much following in the path of working his way to become the next shaman of Anasanka. In fact, he hit me up for $20 to buy new ayahuasca bowls, because they're getting old. I'm in constant contact with the community. In fact, they've seen the film so many times, like through the edit stages. They've watched the rough cut and gave me feedback. And actually, what I found interesting was that they never had any real constructive criticism in terms of the editing or the narrative per se. But what they were really interested in was the sound design. And in the ayahuasca scenes where we have some of the fluid tank visualizations, which, interestingly, what we did with those was take like original artwork from the community and then give it to a fluid tank practical effects guy, and he managed to drop it into a tank and make it move. So it's interestingly, most of their comments were about the sound design. So in those fluid tank visualization scenes, they didn't have too much in the way of notes of the film itself. They kind of loved it from the outset. But most of their creative feedback was around like, oh, dude, you're messing up the ayahuasca scenes. Like you need like more jungle sounds, like more animals, like in the background. Like you're taking it with us. You know what it's like. So.
Was there any moment in the film that sort of where there was a big twist or turn, or there was a big surprise for you, or that something really sort of shifted?
Oh, there were many. I mean, the major one was the death of the shaman. Like, I came up with the title, and it was always meant to be metaphorical. But I'd already finished the rough cut. And I got a text from Geordie, and he was like, well, Raphael just died, and that's why, it was a race against time to get there in time for the funeral. I spent probably 24 hours on the ground to shoot it and had to get out again for various reasons, other things going on. But that was a huge shock, and it was incredibly sad for the community, and you would have seen their reaction in the film to it, and for me as well, because I developed a really strong relationship with the guy over a decade and a half. So that was a big surprise.
Yeah.
And I don't know, getting swept up in a revolution was also somewhat surprising.
And that was Dan Jackson talking about his documentary, The Death of a Shaman, which is showing at MIFF. Coming up next is Publish or Not, because it's the end of the program. We're going to go out with When It Rains, It Pours by Thelma Plum.
Listening to a 3CR podcast produced in the studios of independent community radio station 3CR in Melbourne, Australia. For more information, go to allthews.3cr.org.au. You've been listening to a 3CR podcast produced in the studios of independent community radio station 3CR in Melbourne, Australia. For more information, go to allthews.3cr.org.au.